My name is Martin Bowles. I'm 65. I've been working at Heidelberg University Central Institute of Mental Health for more than 20 years. I was leading a large group mainly dedicated on research on borderline personality disorder. So we covered up a broad field of research from cells to animals to social sciences. And the focus was mainly in the beginning on understanding the mechanism of emotion dysregulation, then more on the mechanism of dysfunctional social interactions, and now mainly focusing on what we call more the identity problems, what borderline patients often have. And one part of the of our research focused on the understanding, the better understanding and also treatment developing for clients who suffered from co-occurring PTSD. As you might know, we have about 50% of treatment-seeking clients with borderline personality disorder. They also suffer or show all the criteria for PTSD, mostly related to childhood sexual abuse. And when we started, there was no treatment for this group of people. And now, after 15 years of work, I can a little bit proudly, with a lot of help of a lot of friends and also with a lot of help of Marshall Linehan, I can say that we now have a treatment on the table, which is has been proven that it's evidence-based, that it works, and it works quite strongly. And so we can now start to distribute the treatment. So this is where we are.
My perspective from the UK is that there's very little research put into the personality disorders field. And a very small part of that research funding is cross-disciplinary, brings together people from the psychological sciences and the biological sciences and the social sciences. It sounds like what you've developed here is that model where you've brought together this cross-disciplinary group of professionals to really think in a very joined up way about the problems that affect people with borderline personality disorder and, as you say, co-occurring complex PTSD. So before we get into the conversation, I just want you to say a little bit more about that group and that life's work. Why have you done that? How did that come about?
Thank you for asking this. Yeah, I think this is a little bit unique. We were very happy that we could achieve this. This my personal background is that I'm trained as a scientist. I've done basic immunology and in the 90s before I started my career as a psychiatrist. So let's say I know a little bit about science. And the other thing is, of course, I'm from my back of my heart, I'm a clinician. And for that, I was always completely convinced that you only can improve the clinical work if you really use basic science, real science, to decover and understand the mechanisms. And then, of course, it's a long way. So I had to start to do my own neurobiological research first. So we've done neuroimaging studies and psychophysiological studies in this group and of patients. And we did also, in the same situation, we did also a large treatment study. And this enabled us then, in the long run, to apply for a specific format. We have a research format in the German Research Foundation, which is something like a research program, which enables us, exactly what you said, to bring together specialists from different fields, like animal researchers, geneticists, neuroimaging people, and also health economic people, and so on, to set up a group of people all focused on what we were focusing that those times is basic mechanism in emotion regulation in borderlines. And we had a research group. This was a funding for 8 years. And we had a group of about 20 scientists coming from all the fields. And we just had to bring them together and One of the important things is what I always do is that I try at least the younger scientists, they have to work with the client a little bit. So that everybody has to treat one client at least, even if she's an animal researcher, of course, under strong supervision and training, so that these scientists know the clients and they, in order that they can develop their own perspectives and adapt it to the needs of the clients and understand the unsolved problems. And this is a very nice situation at the Central Institute of Mental Health. This is the spirit of the whole institute, that that we really try to closely link the basic researchers with the clinicians, and also our basic researchers see the clients, talk with them, and discuss the research results with the clients. And we have in Germany a very strong movement. When I say clients, it means persons with experienced with ex-borderline patients or borderline patients who share and not only on a let's say a so-called advisory board, but they are very closely involved in all our developments. So it's, and I think this is one thing which I could say is a little bit of strength of our group, that we, yeah, we closely work with patients who are experienced, clients who are experienced, and discussing all the details and the research. So that's the situation, and I think it pushed the field forward. Yes. Yeah. Meanwhile, it's a little bit complicated to keep everything in one head. So it's complicated to oversee all the publications and to bring all things together. And then the problem is often that I have the feeling that we are a little bit ahead. So it's complicated to communicate all the things now. And let's say, tell it the DBT community when we're moving forward and reaching other goals. And so it's, yeah, communication now is a problem.
Implementation is always a whole different
separate. Yeah, communication, implementation, utilization. And you see, DBT is a very successful treatment, and it's also a market, and it's all over. And it has some, yeah, I would say, continuity, and now bringing new aspects in it and changing the things is not the easiest part.
So let's get on to the treatment in a second. But first of all, I want to talk a bit about what causes these conditions, BPD, complex PTSD, and also the interplay. You said that 50% of treatment-seeking people with a borderline personality disorder diagnosis also have complex PTSD. So tell us a bit about, in your view, what causes these conditions. And I'm particularly interested in what part genetics and biology play from your perspective.
So I try to explain it in easy words. It's much easier if I can draw something, but I cannot. So let's say, from my model, I think, personally think, that currently the best evidence is for a model, what I call a two roots model. But, yeah, so it has two roots. The one root is comes from genetic, epigenetic, neuropathological roots, with where people were born or, yeah, born with, I would say, some sort of emotional hypersensitivity. And this is, many people now think, okay, this is genetically driven, but it can also be effect of epigenetic problems. Let's say peripartal problems or microlesions or something like that. These people are, let's say, and this is Marshall proposed this very early, and we could show it and demonstrate that it's true. They are super sensitive for the activation of emotions. The emotions are very intense and long lasting. And actually, this itself alone does not cause a borderline personality disorder. This is one route. Then a second part, or component, plays an important role. This is what we call traumatic invalidation. This is Marshall Linehan's term. Traumatic invalidation means that somebody with a very strong emotional sensitivity grows up in a family or a community which just cannot respond to these demands. So they are not trained to really adequately respond to these emotional challenges. So maybe they treat them quite normal, like all the other kids. But then a very super sensitive kid, which needs much more emotional validation, feels non-validated. So this non-validation is a misfitting between demands and what they get. Yeah. So and this is a we've started to do research now on the mechanisms of traumatic invalidation. It's a very 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 strong problem, since it creates the feeling that in the individual that my emotions are not correct. I cannot trust anybody. I cannot trust my own emotions, and I cannot trust myself and others. I'm alone. I'm different than others. And then this results what we call alienation, so that they really cannot rely on what is the most important thing. This means being part of human society or being part of a group. And these two things together, they result in what we called a borderline personality disorder. And this is, I think it's important. This is a transactional process. So this means that somebody with very strong, let's say, emotional reactions causes a lot of irritations in their parents. And sometimes, without any intentions, they just cannot yet react adequately, which again increases the behavioral patterns and. So these are vicious circuits, and often the parents are completely overwhelmed and by this challenge, and they're simply not trained for that. So this is the one part. And the other part comes from severe real traumata. To real means physical traumatization and sexual traumatization. 50% report about sexual traumatization and others about physical traumatization. And again, this experience alone causes PTSD, but does not cause what we call complex PTSD. So again, here is the combination of a sexual traumatization and traumatic invalidation. This means the impossible, the inability to share this traumatic experience with the caregivers. For example, what we experience all and over is, let's say the kid has been abused by the grandfather and she tries to tell it to her mother, and the mother just say, "What are you telling about? So this is my father. He doesn't do things like that. So you are a little bitch. And it's, do you have crazy fantasies? I beat you up if you say it once again." So this is what happens, what we call a double hit problem. The one hit is the sexual traumatization. The second hit is the social traumatization. And those things together result in what we call complex PTSD. And now comes the real problem. What is the difference between borderline personality disorder and complex PTSD? And I can say, I think nobody in the world can tell you really science-based, evidence-based, the difference. If you look only at the diagnostic criteria, then what you have is if you have, let's say, 50% of all borderline patients don't report sexual abuse. So this is another group. Yeah, and the group with sexual abuse, they report, of course, the PTSD symptoms like intrusions, flashbacks, hyperarousal and avoidance. And also identity problems, what so-called identity problems, what we call now problems with emotion regulation, social interaction, and extremely negative self-esteem. And these three, criteria, which are now the ICD-11 criteria, they exactly fit to the core problems of borderlines. So clinically, one can say that maybe you can discriminate so-called borderlines, traumatized borderlines, since they are a little bit more complicated in the social interactions. They have a lot of troubles to stay alone. They are more or less dependent on the social interaction, whereas the classic complex PTSD often are happy to be alone and live a life more, let's say, detached. Yeah. So And but you can also say it's a question of the of age, of severity, of type and timing. And all this research hasn't been done yet. So we have now the Central Institute under the leadership of Christian Schmal. We have a huge research project focusing on the impact of type and timing of trauma on the pathology. And it has a lot to do with different brain morphology. Let's say specific time and frequencies have a specific impact on the hippocampal area or the insula or other areas, which of course then have another impact on the development of the pathology. So this is what is start to treatment. The problem is that it's very complicated to really have robust data, since post hoc, the memories on let's say age of 3, 4, 5 are not very valid. So you cannot really rely on this data. So it gets complicated.
And before we talk about treatment, I just wanted to ask you about potential preventative approaches, thinking about this traumatic invalidation that you mentioned there. What do you think can be done, or what is being done, to prevent people from developing borderline personality disorder in the first place?
Yeah, I would say the very first thing is when you talk about prevention, you always have to talk about the primary, secondary prevention. I think primary prevention is very complicated to give. This means a general education process on borderline is complicated to provide. But what I would say, we know that it's a transactional process, and we know that the quicker, the earlier, and the more concrete we help the parents to learn skills, to learn a more validating and more emotion-focused interaction processes, the better it is. So I think the approaches which, let's say, for instance, Al Frasetti has put on the table with his family interventions, which can provide short-term education programs in the early time of the development of the disorder, let's say, so that clients at the age of 14, 15, parents of the age of 14, 15, they are involved and included in the treatments. This should help a little bit. So I would say, yes, early interventions and early primary interventions, and taking the parents or the caregivers, including them in the treatment programs. That would I say would be the next step.
Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely. So tell us about your treatment.
Yeah, the story is quickly told. So the problem in DBT was for years that it was an effective treatment. We knew that from many data, but we figured out that borderline patients with co-occurring PTSD didn't make much success. So they were a little bit better in their, let's say, emotion regulation and distress tolerance capabilities, but PTSD simply didn't disappear. And this makes total sense, since these are trauma-specific problems, which are really related to the trauma memory. And if you don't directly target the trauma memory, nothing happens. So this was in the beginning of the 20s when Marsha, we were sitting together with Marsha and said, okay, there's a strong need now to improve the treatment and to develop new interventions. And then there were two approaches. The one said, okay, we take standard DBT and add a protocol of etnophoa, what was called prolonged exposure, Melanie Hornet disease approach. And I started with that, but then I saw, no, this is not sufficient. We have to be much more specific to the requirements of the disorder, and we have to learn on very specific emotions which are strongly related to trauma. In early trauma, this is we learned a lot on guilt, the mechanism of guilt as a coping mechanism against powerlessness. We learned a lot on disgust, since disgust is a central problem in almost everybody who has been traumatized very early. And this disgust becomes part of the self system, so they feel themselves disgustive, and then shame, which is closely related to disgust, And then this results in assumptions like I'm dirty, or everybody sees it, everybody smells it, I cannot go out on the streets since people know what happened, and so on. So this, on the first perspective, weird assumptions make total sense if you understand the mechanism and the coping strategies and survival strategies, the mental surviving strategies of a sexual abused child. And then you come up with, we have to understand guilt, shame, disgust, self-contempt. And we have to design a treatment which specifically not only focus on improvement of reduction of intrusions and flashbacks, frequency and intrusion, which is easily be done if you provide exposure treatment. But we also have to target the extremely negative self concept. We have to target the problems with social interaction. We have to target the body concepts. And we have also to understand how can we provide exposure in clients who are prone to severe dissociative features. And since dissociation is an automatized process, which is blunting amygdala and hippocampus, and we have to know and to teach the therapists what they can do to block the dissociation during the exposure, since otherwise the brain doesn't learn. And this was the advantage of our group, since we did a lot of neurocognitive studies on dissociation, and we learned how to block dissociation. And so we learned how we can apply exactly targeted exposure in under non-dissociative conditions. And the last thing what we just brought in now is that we learned a lot how to change what we call a dysfunctional self-concept. You not only have to, help the clients to question their own assumptions, but you have to help the clients to develop a new point of new perspective towards themselves. And there Marsha has already set the grains for it. She developed a concept, what she called it wise mind. And wise mind is the old Buddhistic concept, including loving kindness, compassion, joy for others, and serenity. And we strengthened this component in DBT and from the very beginning, our patients train up an imago of this wise mind, which we then can use also during the exposure technique. So as you see, it's a multi-component, closely interwoven design. It's based on a self-help manual with about 350 pages. So it's more than a classic therapist-guided treatment. So it's a blended treatment. So therapists, clients work about 30 minutes per day with audio tapes and handouts and worksheets. And therapists work for 1 hour per week. And so this blended treatment, I hope, it's mainly focused and helps to develop, not only a better self-esteem, but also a self-efficiency, so that clients learn that they don't depend only on the mercy of the therapist, but they are capable people who really can do a lot of that work for themselves.
And tell us about how you studied this and over what period. That sounds like a really intensive treatment. Over what period have your studies gone?
Yeah, so of course, when you develop this treatment, we started in 2003. So, and the first problem was that we were in the beginning, we were convinced that you cannot target a trauma in a patient who's chronically suicidal, self-harming, highly dissociative. And then it was just something, when I talked with Marsha and said, Marsha, what could we do? And she said, hey, they have to learn skills before that you can target the trauma. And then I said, okay, what to do with those clients who cut themselves in order to reduce their flashbacks? And then both of us sit together and said, okay, maybe what are our data? So that was one of the nice talks with her. We said, are we really sure this is what we are? It's written, but do we have data for that? And then I said, okay, let's try it out. And they had the big advantage that in Germany we have this these units. So we have residential units. Yeah? A residential unit is a 3-month residential treatment. It's an open ward where people can apply for. And then insurance companies pay, since we could show that it's working and they have good data. So they pay for 12 weeks of residential treatment. And we have highly trained staff there. So nurses know how to handle suicidal acts, and they know how to handle self-harm. And then we said, okay, just let's try it out. Let's start with an exposure-based treatment and really taking everybody from the very beginning without a stage one phase. And then we did it under residential conditions, and we figured out that our assumptions were wrong. So we did not have any any suicide attempts. We didn't have more self-harm events. So, and we very carefully analyzed our data, and we that's also published meanwhile. There was no increase, not even in suicidal threats or something like that. And then we learned, okay, this treatment seems to be quite safe. And the other thing is that we really did individual analysis and figured out that not one patient got worse, even that we had really clear exposure-based treatment, and everybody was on exposure after the third week of treatment. And we didn't have one case where this problems exacerbated what we all assumed. And then we said, okay, now that we know that the 3 months residential treatment is safe and effective, we did an RCT on compared our residential treatment to a treatment as usual waitlist. This is not a very strong design, but it showed that at least we didn't harm, and we could do it, and patients accepted it, and we had a very strong effect size, a pre-post effect size, and also between group effect size of 1.4. So in the CAPS, so maybe you're familiar with this effect size assessment. So you usually say, okay, if you have a treatment, so between 0.3 and 0.6, it's mediocre. Everything what is higher than 0.8 is strong, and the treatment effect of 1.4, you can say this is extremely strong, heavy, a good working treatment. And then we decided, okay, now let's take the same design, the same content, and bring it and design it as an outpatient treatment. So this means we took all the contents in individual therapy and manualized it in a way that one single therapist can provide the treatment in 45 sessions without a group, only an individual therapist, 45 sessions. And we did also our pre-studies and figured out that it seemed to work. And then we tested it in a large RCT with around about 200 clients. And tested it in a multi-center trial in Germany against the pediatrics treatment. This is cognitive processing therapy. Cognitive processing therapy is currently one of the best established treatments for, severe traumatized clients in the U.S. And it's mainly cognitive. So we choose this treatment since we said, okay, then we can compare DBD PTSD is an exposure-based treatment versus a strong cognitive treatment. And one of the reasons was that there was this rumor that the more cognitive treatments are better tolerable and they are emotional and not so distressing. And we thought, okay, let's take a really fair comparison. We asked Patty Resick, who is the treatment developer, whether she wants to supervise gets the PI of this treatment arm. She trained all the therapists. She supervised the group. So I think this was quite fair, since usually if you compare a treatment which designed by the developer to another one, then you always have your developer bias. So there were the two developers, me and Patty, together running the treatment. And the results we found are very, very convincing. So first of all, both treatments work. And the effect size of pediatric treatments is about 1. The effect size of DBD-PTSD is, again, 1.4 or 1.45. And we have significant superiority of the DBDP-3 treatment in all belongings. So, so we were happy about that. Of course, this has to be replicated, and this is a one shot. But now, at least, we can show that it works, and our dropout rates. Exactly what you say is, and our inclusion criteria those times were clients suffering from the sequelae of childhood sexual abuse plus minimum 3 borderline criteria, including emotion dysregulation. Those times we did not have an ICD-11 diagnosis, so we could not have an assessment. We did a sub-analysis on these 100 patients who suffered from full-blown borderline. This means 5 and more criteria. And we figured out the same results. That's just published in Journal of Consulting, we got the same effect sizes. So actually, it works for both, for classic complex PTSD and for severe borderline patients with PTSD. So yes, that's the situation.
You know, I'm persuaded, having listened to you speak for the last half an hour, that there's a huge amount of content here that is very relevant to people, both people working with clients at the front line, but also other researchers.
So why should you listen to the talk?
Yeah, why should they come along?
So I would say if you are a clinician, if you're working with borderline patients, you should listen to this talk, since every second patient you're treating is suffering from complex PTSD. And the currently only evidence-based treatment is DBD-PTSD, which has a long-lasting development phase, yes, but it has now very strong data. And it's sure that you cannot apply the treatment, but you know whether you would run a course later. So this treatment can be learned in 4 days. If you are a behavioral therapist and if you have at least a little bit of an idea of basics and principles of DBT, it takes you 4 days. You get a manual, and in 4 days you can start to treat to work with your clients. And I think your clients are worth it. That's all.